NASA 557, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say we've got three sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety. The Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, Piston Power, and Avemco Insurance, a world-class provider of aviation insurance.
Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead. Well, hello, Todd.
Hi there, John.
All right, it's you and I today, and we're going to do a couple upgrades or updates to some recent events, mainly the what's going on in Newark, New Jersey. And I spent a few days last week down there myself, and the NTSB. So why don't we, why don't you pick which one you want to start with?
Well, we'll start with the Newark situation, because that's literally a breaking news story. As we're doing this recording, which is on Monday, May 12, 2025, Newark right now is in a situation where, because of staffing and other issues, there's been a slowdown in flights going through the airport. And for those of you watching the video version of this, I just flashed up a statement that is currently on the FAA's website about delays at Newark, saying the delays of about 1 hour and 41 minutes. And from other sources, these are delays where the planes aren't being allowed to leave from their origin airports while they're sorting things out. And the things they're sorting out are a combination of technical failures and staffing shortages. Over the last 3 weeks, 2 weeks rather, there have been three events where the airport had some serious issues. A couple times there was a radar situation where the radar went blank, short period of time, minute and a half. And other periods where they've had a shortage of staff. Now, stories that vary as to how many staff are on duty, but the bottom line is there is a certain number of controllers who have to be present in order to process the traffic. And it's unclear whether or not there was those number of staffers there, or whether they were fully qualified to be able to do the handling of the aircraft with the people they did have on board. So again, this is being sorted out. There's a lot of political, let's just say, conversation going on. Current FAA head, Sean Duffy, is blaming the previous administration for the situation at Newark. These are situations, you can speak to this, John, that have been ongoing at Newark, partly because of old technology, partly because of what else is going on in the New York City area with respect to airports.
Well, you know, I left the board 15 years ago, and we were talking about the equipment problems then. So this is, the equipment side is nothing new. And all the administrations in the 2000s have kicked the can down the road, because it's A, going to be very, very expensive, and B, very disruptive to the air transportation system. So it's not going to be an easy job to fix it. Now, separate from that, we've had issues. NTSB has had issues in the New York area for a while. And both LaGuardia and JFK have taken a very firm hand in stopping expansion beyond the points where it was when they stopped it. So if you want to introduce something new to LaGuardia today, you're not going to get in there. Same thing with JFK, you're not going to get in there. But what I've been watching and wondering how they're doing it over the last several years is, you know, Singapore wants to run a nonstop to Singapore, then they run it out of Newark. They were allowed to bring them in and run it. So I never looked at it, but I was concerned. What's going on in Newark? Why are they overloading it? And then, in the last 20 years, United has come in there with blazing saddles, so to speak, and just built up their hub. Every single schedule change, they've added more to their hub. In fact, at one point years ago, they actually pulled out of JFK and moved all those flights over to Newark to condense their operation. So they're only in two of the three airports in New York. And so they're very dependent upon Newark. Now, on the recent problems that have occurred down there, and I was down to Newark just recently talking to people about this. The recent problems that Kirby, the president of United Airlines, has been making a lot of noise over, deal with the staffing issues at the center that's out on Long Island that handles the flow into Newark and all three airports, actually, and the need to build up their staffing, and they can't seem to get anybody that wants to go out to Long Island because you don't make enough money to live in that area. So Kirby was pushing and pushing for several years to move that Newark piece of it to Philadelphia, which they recently did. And there was, I believe the number was 30 positions that were assigned to that Newark segment. And 24 of them went to Philadelphia, but four of them were TDY, meaning they were going back to New York. So it went to 20. So they had a 30% openings below staffing levels. And they were working on that. One of the problems that the FAA has is that you need air traffic controllers that know how to train the new guys. So, and they don't have any extra air traffic controllers because they're all working the positions. And they're all working an awful lot of overtime because they're down 30% of the staff. So it's just a position where you just can't catch up. So I feel sorry for the FAA in that point, but they brought it on themselves years ago when they tried to get creative with their hiring processes. And while they were in the midst of that, along came COVID and just shut down everything from the hiring and the staffing. And meanwhile, the retirements keep going on and on. And we've known for a long time that they were going to have a big slug of retirements in this time frame, because they hired a whole bunch 40 years ago.
This is a situation that didn't just happen overnight. So when the head of the FAA was blaming the previous administration, from your experience, this is something that's been going on for over a decade, which includes the previous time this administration was in office. So it's a complex problem, and you can easily point and say, well, the technology is old, et cetera, et cetera. The technology for air traffic control, from the buildings to the people to the computers, evolves over time. You just can't rip everything out and put everything back in. It has to keep working while you're upgrading and improving. So yes, are some of the some parts of the system antiquated in compared to what you can get off the shelf right now for a similar function? Perhaps it is. Will they be changed? They probably will. Newark is a very important airport. Now you mentioned about United. It's one of their hub airports, which means if you have any kind of delay for any plane coming into Newark, that's a United plane. It has downstream effects affecting passengers for hours and days on end. So it's particularly frustrating if you're flying through Newark and there's a weather delay or a technical delay or any kind of delay. And again, because of the way Newark is laid out, because of the traffic that goes through there, and because of the importance United has, it has a national effect when you have a problem at Newark.
There's no question about it that Newark is a very key ingredient, especially in the north-south traffic and in the east coast of the United States. How they're going to fix it is beyond me. Years ago, and I'm talking about 30 years ago, I remember in Singapore when they upgraded their radar system, and Singapore is nowhere near what the FAA needs to do. But one of the things that Raytheon did with those people in Singapore is they stood up a separate air traffic control system in its entirety, and it was not being used until one day they turned the switch and turned the old one off and the new one on. And they had to change locations of the tower, you know. So it was two parallel systems, and they just switched one day. And it did have some hiccups, but it still was better than what we're having here normally. We got equipment problems, we got manpower problems, and we have airspace that's crowded. One of the things that scared the hell out of me, talking to controllers just 10 days ago, with that first outage that got everybody's attention, was the 90 seconds, and that's not been confirmed, but that's just what was said. 90-second blackout, where they actually had two of the 27 airplanes that were on the scope intruded into LaGuardia airspace, which we've had a mid-air years ago for that very reason, and it was scary. And now you add to that event, you have Scott Kirby from United telling everybody they walked out in the airport in Newark. The fact of the matter is, when that whole team just went crazy trying to make sure they had no collisions, trying to get communications reestablished, talking to other centers to see if they could see them, if their radar was picking them up, a whole bunch of things that they were doing. One of the individuals on the scope, when it settled down, when they got radar back and they pulled some of those people off the positions, he was found in the hallway shivering uncontrollably. I mean, he was just that shaken up. And the FAA requires, when you get involved with any kind of a situation like that, or handling an accident, you know, a mid-air or other any kind of accident, that if you are involved in it, they want you off the scope. They want you out of there because you're not, you know, until you settle down, you're not fit to be there. And you might seem like you want to be, you know, helpful, you want to stay, but it's not always the case. And the management just wants you off the scope because they can't make those mental health evaluations. So they're just going to put you over on the side until somebody above their pay grade or professional, a doctor, can say, okay, he's settled back down, he's okay to return to work. And so that's very complicated.
That brings up another potential mental health issue. If you're a controller working in Newark right now, your job is in the news. You're being mentioned in the news. Maybe you're not being mentioned personally, but it's got to wear on a person to know that their professionalism, their competence is being called into question, even if it's indirectly being called into question. And we're just talking about the mainstream news services. If you go online, there's all sorts of commentary from podcasts and elsewhere that are, well, let's just say, less than diplomatic. So that has to wear down a person.
Yes. Yes, and I've seen that in the airline business too. The same thing. When the headlines after an accident are accusing either the pilots or maintenance people or some portion of the airline, it has a big effect on the employees. So it's all intertwined. It needs to be, the FAA needs to finally... It's not the FAA's fault. When it boils down to, the administration and Congress needs to work together to put our air traffic control system back together the way it used to be. And not by last year, I'm talking about maybe by two decades ago, when it was robust and it had expansion room in there and didn't have equipment breaking down every day. I mean, we've had outages now, I think, three times in the last 10 or 12 days. I mean, that's unacceptable. And it's old infrastructure, and they need to, in the case of Newark and maybe some other areas, they need to fix that separate from the new system that they need to design and implement. So that's even more money, because you're going to have to put something new into Newark and others, to make sure that these problems don't happen while you're building the new system. So it's just going to be very, very expensive.
And another thing about this situation, and we've mentioned this before with the earlier events in 2025, when you have an event that is in a major media center. We had the mid-air collision in Washington, D.C., and other things happening. When it happens, and we had the helicopter crash in New York not too long ago, these become national stories. Yes, they're important. Yes, there are risks. Yes, it has to be addressed. This would be an all-hands-on-deck affair, no matter what airport it was in the country. But when you have it happening in New York in this particular case, you have the national media focusing on this for days on end, with late-breaking news coming across the wires and coming across the internet. And just before we did the show, we saw something where on CBS News, they were saying, well, one of the statements from the FAA is that they might reduce the traffic coming into Newark from like 70 per hour to 56 per hour through June as they fix this problem. Now, in my opinion, the basket of problems that happen that is happening right now in Newark will not be fixed by June. Some parts of it will be fixed by June. Some parts of it will certainly be addressed. You can move people around and get higher staffing temporarily. But the deeper issues you talked about, the technical issues, the infrastructure issues, that's going to take a lot more time than just a month or two.
Yes, and they should have been working on this a long time ago, and they haven't. And it's not just the three New York airports that are a problem. I mean, we have it in other areas as well. Although some of the staffing in other areas of the country are better because the workforce is more stable. For the longest time, if you worked for the FAA New York metro area, you couldn't transfer anywhere. Because they couldn't replace you, so they wouldn't let you go. And I understand that they have loosened that a little bit. A few people have escaped from New York. Maybe it's the easy way to say it. But not many because they're so short of people. So the other thing is they're going to have to gear up Oklahoma City, and they're going to have to do what they stopped. You know, nobody's talking about this piece, but 6 years ago, 7 years ago, the FAA stopped hiring students that go to colleges for air traffic control. So they have a 4-year college degree plus extensive education in air traffic control. And they were not hiring them for all those years. And finally, just now, they're saying they're going to bring them in instantly, put them in the low-use towers until they can route them through the Oklahoma Training Center to get them fully qualified to work bigger towers, bigger areas.
And just
So.
for the audience that might not be clued into how air traffic control training works, all FAA controllers are trained through the training center in Oklahoma City. And that's been the case for decades.
Yes. So even though they come out of college understanding it, or come out of the military understanding it, except after the strike in the 80s, everybody goes through Oklahoma City. So that's not going to change. What they're going to have to do in Oklahoma City is expand it because they need to hire more people than they can currently run through the Oklahoma City program. So, and that's going to be more controllers that are going to have to go to Oklahoma City to work with the new hires. So it's everywhere you look for the FAA, they got a problem.
And like pilots, air traffic controllers age out after a certain age, and I believe that age is 55. They can't be controllers anymore.
Correct. And they're pretty, you know, I know a lot of controllers that have made it to 55, and not all of them, but a good number of them are pretty spent. I mean, it's this very stressful job. And, you know, with the equipment problems and all the other problems with traffic, weather, you know, the equipment on the airplanes, nobody's talking about that. But the equipment on the airplane sometimes fails. The transponders fail. And it just doubles and triples the workload for the air traffic controllers when you start having problems, especially intermittent problems with the aircraft systems. So there's just so many moving parts, and they're all interdependent on one another, that one hiccup in some place ends up causing massive problems and delays in the system. So it needs to be a priority. It needs to be addressed like it is critical, and it needs to have some money and people thrown at it, to fix it. And we're going to pay the price for not doing it earlier.
We're going to take a short break now to meet one of Avemco's employees from their Frederick, Maryland office.
Hi, my name is Marcy Veroni, and I'm in charge of training the underwriters that work here at Avemco. We have a Redbird simulator that we use in our training. It's a 172S model. Our local flight school also has 172s, so we hope that the non-pilots get the interest to go and then become pilots. But regardless, everybody that work here goes through ground school, either Sporties or King, and then we actually put them in the sim. We hire local CFIs to come in and take them through different scenarios. Then we take them to the airport. They've all watched an engine being torn down. They've all pre-flighted an airplane. Most of them have gone for a flight in an airplane. But the reason why I really like the sim is when there is a claim somewhere around the country, we're able to bring our team in here and fly the scenario and kind of teach them the mindset of the pilot and might have, you know, what went wrong. Or is there anything from our point of view that we can help with the next caller that maybe wants to buy that airplane or do the scenario? So
when you're talking to an Avemco underwriter, you're getting somebody who really understands aviation. Even if they don't have a pilot certificate, they do understand aviation. You can tell them your story, you can give them your information, and they can do a fair and appropriate evaluation to issue you insurance.
And now, back to the flight safety detectives.
And switching gears to a related issue that's happening right now, also in aviation, but not at the FAA, but at the NTSB. About a week ago, we had an unprecedented event where an NTSB board member was essentially dismissed, no reason given. This is the vice chair, Alvin Brown, who's a former mayor of, I believe it was Jacksonville, Florida, has been on the board since March of 2024, about 14 months, and he was let go. There's nothing really coming out of the administration as to why he was let go, although our suspicion, talking before the show, is that this is a person who was appointed by the previous president and who was also involved in high-level Democratic politics for quite a number of years. And this administration has let go of a variety of appointed officials who had those kinds of connections. But this event with the NTSB is kind of unusual because has this ever happened before where somebody is just asked to
leave? No, this is in my knowledge of the NTSB, and my knowledge is pretty good. It has never happened before. We all knew, all the board members knew that we served at the pleasure of the administration. So that we all knew that we could be, you know, a phone call from the White House and we could be gone. So, you know, it's there, you don't really think about it. And it's never happened before. The only thing that's anywhere near that was there was one person that was nominated to the NTSB more than 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. And maybe 34 or 35 years ago. And he got what they call a recess appointment. Congress was not in. In other words, they were on vacation or some reason they were not in session. So he was appointed as a recess. And in a recess appointment, you stay in the job until the end of that Congress. So usually that's the end of the year. And they never picked up his nomination. So at the end of the year, when Congress adjourned, he wasn't voted on by Congress. He's out. So he's the only one that I know that happened to. So this case where they have been confirmed by the U.S. Senate and then have them removed is totally unprecedented. So, and I don't know that we'll ever find out the reason, because the White House doesn't have to give any reason. And like I said, we all knew that was hanging over our head. And but it never had happened before. So I don't know. I wish him well, and I hope it's not the reason. I hope the reason is politics and not something criminal.
Now, as far as his performance on the board, again, as I said before, he was only on the board about 14 months. In your experience, how long does a board member have to be on the board before they get into the rhythm of how things are done and start taking leading positions and start being more prominent when it comes to aviation safety?
Most of the board members that I worked with and I knew prior to my going to the board were always very anxious and excited about getting involved in the events, and they were looking to learn. So they were always having staff come in and brief them, going to sites, looking at equipment. They were involved. This particular guy, as I look through past events, his name's pretty seen infrequently. I don't know if that's an indication of his level of engagement. I'm not there to really make a judgment on that, but it's certainly something that says, where was he when all this, when everything was going on? Because they've had a pretty busy time, especially trucks and train crashes. And he should have been very visible in some of those. So I don't know. So we're speculating all over the place here with the reasons for his departure, when there really even that doesn't need to have a reason. The only reason that the White House needs is they want him out.
Now, if he's out, that means there's an open slot and someone else will be put in that person's place. And historically, board members have come from aviation and other transportation areas. Some have come from non-transportation backgrounds. Some have come from political or inside the beltway sort of backgrounds. Is there any word out there as to who might be considered or who should be considered?
No, it's pretty quiet. I asked that question myself. Is there somebody waiting in the wings to take this? The White House always has a list of people, but sometimes they're looking for the qualifications. You know, the statute says that 3 of the 5 board members are supposed to have technical expertise, but recent administrations have stretched that a little bit with, less than technical skills. So we'll have to wait and see what they do with this position. So it's going to be, like everything else in government today, we're in an area that we've never experienced before. I mean, it's just, I don't know how, the president is the guy at the top, and he has a million people that are nipping at his ear all the time to get his attention to do this and do that. And I don't know how he's keeping it all straight, because every time you turn, there's something else in it. And all this tariff stuff has got to be so time-consuming on the staff level in the White House, just trying to keep track of all of that stuff. And it's clear that they're controlling it from the White House, not from the agencies. So it's just amazing what's going on. I'm glad to be an observer from the sidelines.
Well, I think this is time for a second to last word. I just came up with a new concept for second to last word. Rather than giving my opinion on what we've talked about, how about throwing in something else out of the blue into the mix? What do you think about the apparent offer from a foreign government to gift the U.S. government a 747 to be used as Air Force One? Personally, my first thought was, assuming this happens, Air Force One is a military aircraft. This current aircraft is a civilian aircraft. There would be months or years of upgrades and changes to the aircraft before it could act as an Air Force One. So, and we spoke about this off camera, I think what this is not a situation where this airplane is going to be used for Air Force One, but sort of like a catalyst to get Boeing to hurry up with the 2 aircraft that are being currently upgraded as Air Force One. Does your opinion stick with that?
It does fit with that. Most people don't realize that the changes to that 747 to be Air Force One are extensive. For one, the generators on the engines are huge. I forget the specifications on them, but they are so large that the engine cowling actually has a bulge in it so that it keeps it in. So the, because of the amount of electronics that are on the airplane, you know, there's safety measures, electronics, you know, for man pads, for missiles. I mean, it's the security electronics so that the president can communicate without being listened to. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. Refueling capability. They could probably get away without that. But the point is, it's not a regular 747. It may look like it on the outside if you don't look too closely, like for the bulges and the cowling or the number of antennas all over the airplane. But it's not a regular 747. So what they're going to do with that is, I have no idea. And it's probably legal for them to do that. But, you know, without all the security protocols in there, I don't know how they're going to make it work.
And I sort of agree with you there. Even if it is gifted to the United States government, it might be years before that airplane sees service as Air Force One, if at all. And the two Boeing planes that are being refurbished right now, they'll probably be ready for action before this airplane would be ready for action. So this has been a sort of eventful month. In fact, it's been an eventful year. And perhaps next week's show will be another breaking set of news articles. And I hope it has nothing to do with Newark Airport.
Yes. Yes, I hope they get a handle on Newark. You know, if they need to cut the flights back, it's unfortunate, but they need to get it down to protect the traveling public. You know, it isn't a question of the economics for United. Fortunately for United, they have another hub that's in Dulles that doesn't have the same kind of problems. And it's only, you know, flying, it's only about 30 minutes away. So they could conceivably switch off some of that flight, that traffic into Dulles. Less convenient for the New York market, but, you know, what can you do? And as a society, we really need to do some more work on the train, because we really shouldn't be flying airplanes from Boston to New York or Washington to New York. That all should be real high-speed train. You know, the Chinese, I think, just had some ridiculous number of their train. I did their maglev train, and it was 380 miles an hour. I forget. It was wicked fast, the train. And they just broke the record just within the last couple of weeks for maglev to even go faster, because they're a big country and they could use the train to go, you know, to run faster. We need to do that too. Brightline's going to do a fast train from Miami to Orlando and beyond. They have grade crossing issues there. Brightline's also going to build one from LA to San Francisco. And most of that's going to be in desert areas. So with wide open land, they can do a lot more than they can do in the Northeast. So we need to take a step back. Our government needs to take a step back and lay out an orderly plan on the future of transportation in our very crowded areas. You know, Houston to Dallas, another area that's heavily traveled that could benefit from a high-speed train operation. So this administration's got a lot on their plate, and it does seem like they've chosen to take some of this on. So it's going to be interesting to see how this develops.
And with that, it's time for the last word.
And I'll use the standard last word that we use all the time about, if you're going to go flying, please do a good job of pre-planning your flight before you get to the airport. Do it again at the airport. Make sure they agree. When you get out to the airplane, do a very thorough pre-flight. I spoke at a maintenance conference a week ago, a little more than a week ago, and I encouraged, there was about 1,000 maintenance people there. I encouraged them to talk to their pilots and make sure they understand what they're looking at. Right? So, because I found too many pilots don't know what they're looking at. And I got a very interesting email reminding me of something that I knew that I have not mentioned in this final word, and that is a post pre-flight. And I was trained as a mechanic by United Airlines when a young kid. And I was taught every time you move an airplane, tow it, taxi it, whatever the reason, you move it, you do a walk around after you get done. The last thing you do, walk around the airplane and look at it. And I have found problems when I did that. One of the most obvious was if you have airplane tires because of landing get flat spots, means that when they touch the ground, they might touch heavy, it burns off more rubber. So now the tire, instead of being round, it's got a little dip in it, burn rubber. I don't know how, but inevitably that ends up on the bottom. And I have been caught myself. When you're pushing the airplane back, suddenly you see the tire and it needs to be replaced. And now you gotta deal with it. And I actually have, in moving an airplane, I found a tire in similar circumstances. So don't forget, pilots, even commercial pilots, do a walk around when you get through with your airplane, especially in non-maintenance stations. Most people don't realize, but we don't have maintenance in every station. United Airlines has 100 and something locations domestically that they fly in, but they probably only have maintenance in 20 or 25 of those. And some of those 20 or 25 are midnight shift only. So, pilots should do a walk around just so that they identify what's wrong with their airplane before it's the last minute. Because they do a pre-flight everywhere they stop, but it's before they get on the airplane to leave. And then all of a sudden everybody's going crazy because you got to change a tire, or you got to service hydraulics, or you got to service oxygen. I mean, it's just the list goes on and on. But if that was done when the airplane landed, you have a better chance of leaving without taking a delay. So, and after you get off the ground, after you do your pre-flight and your cockpit preparations, put that head on a swivel. In my conversations recently with air traffic controllers, they talk about events that they see that were not necessarily reportable, but could have been a disaster if they had continued and people caught it before it got that far. So put that head on a swivel. Don't get involved in somebody else's accident. Right? See and avoid isn't the best method, but it's the only method we have right now. And please, please fly safely.
Thank you so much for listening to the show. We really value all of our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you. So if you like this, give us 5 stars inside your podcast platform.
We want to keep the conversation going with you. So we'd love for you to engage with us on our social media channels. We're on Instagram, X, Facebook, LinkedIn, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetothetexas@gmail.com. By the way, if you're watching this on YouTube, we're working on growing this channel, and it really helps if you all comment. So please do that. We read them all.
And be sure to subscribe.
Avemco Insurance Company has thousands of 5-star reviews on Trustpilot.com. Here's one from Henry K., who said, "For more than 18 years, Avemco has insured me and my aircraft. The cost has been very reasonable and the service excellent. Completely satisfied. The only claim I ever had was handled quickly and to my complete satisfaction. Avemco is a first-rate insurer." Experience the advantage going direct with Avemco Insurance Company. Call 888-879-0389 for a free quote or visit avemco.com/flightsafety. And don't forget to tell them the Flight Safety Detective sent you for 5% off your premium.